This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, a nonpartisan law and policy institute that works to improve the systems of democracy and justice. Michael was director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton from 1995 to 1999 and is author of The Second Amendment, My Fellow Americans, POTUS Speaks, and three other books. Michael Waldman is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Fight to Vote, published in 2016. Welcome, Michael.
It's great to be here.
What is the goal or purpose of your book, The Fight to Vote?
Well, it goes without saying, living through an election where American democracy is under pressures and stresses and strains it hasn't seen in a long, long time. In 16 states, there are new laws on the books to make it harder to vote for the first time in a high turnout election. It's the first presidential election in half a century without the full strength of the Voting Rights Act because the Supreme Court gutted it a few years ago. It's the first election where the full impact of Citizens United is being felt in our politics. It's not a surprise that in the last election, turnout fell to its lowest level in 72 years. And given all these challenges for our democracy, I wanted to understand and I wanted to tell the readers, why is this happening now and is it new? And in fact, these controversies are intense, they are consequential, but they're not new. They've been going on all throughout American history. The fight to vote, the fight to make sure that people have their voice heard and a seat at the table and the ability to be part of our democracy, that's something that's been at the heart of American politics and often at the center of election debates for all the time we've been a country. And the purpose of this book is to tell the true story of the rise of American democracy and where we are now.
From the beginning of the country to the present, what arguments have been made in debates about who should have the right to vote?
Well, you're right in that there's been almost two strains of this argument. From the beginning, there was an understanding that, as our founding documents said, Thomas Jefferson, in writing the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, wrote that government is legitimate only when it rests, as he said, on the consent of the governed. And that basic concept of legitimacy and of a Republican government, implicitly of democracy, that's been the core of the American sort of civic religion. And there's been a different view, which has wanted to actually limit the right to vote, to restrict the power of kind of everyday people, often a fear that the more people got involved, the more corruptible elections were, the more corruptible the voters were. And you kind of hear those arguments for democracy or fear of what democracy might produce from the founding till today's cable news debates.
What role has the U.S. Constitution played in the fight to vote?
It's an interesting thing. At the time of the Revolution and the time the country got started, only white men who owned property were allowed to vote. That was the tradition handed down from England. And that was generally accepted by the people who made the Revolution, but even then it was controversial too. Benjamin Franklin, one of the heroes of this book, passionately believed that there ought to be a right to vote regardless of wealth. He fought for and actually kind of led a working man's revolt in Pennsylvania in 1776 to have the widest voting rights for men without property. And it was the most radical constitution in the world at the time. And Franklin said, there's a man who owns a jackass, so he can vote. Then the jackass dies. The man is wiser. He has better knowledge of government. But the jackass is dead, so the man cannot vote. Who, therefore, has the right of suffrage, the man or the jackass? And he made that argument pretty well, as he was known to do. The other argument was heard from someone like John Adams, who was aghast at the notion of wider participation and wider voting rights. He said, if you took away the property requirement, he said, women will demand the right to vote. Lads of 18 will think their interests insufficiently attended to, and they will demand the right to vote. And men who have not a farthing to their name, as Adams put it, will think themselves worthy of an equal voice in government, and they will demand the right to vote. There will be no end of it. And he was right. There was no end of it. That basically sums up a lot of the later subsequent history of American democracy. And the Constitution does not refer one way or the other to who can vote. They decided to maintain the property requirement in some places and let it go in others. They didn't want to put it in the Constitution. So it was silent. And that silence has had a big impact over the years. It took five separate constitutional amendments made by we the people to actually state explicitly the right to vote in the Constitution.
What role have political parties played in the fight to vote?
It's a really interesting thing to me because, like a lot of people, you know, I think we're all mortified sometimes by the polarization and partisanship that we see. A lot of times there's an assumption that party bosses must be the villain. A lot of the fight has been raw and raucous and very partisan. It's always been the political parties who have played a particularly important role in fighting to expand the base of participation and expand democracy. And it's also the case that sometimes political parties fight to restrict the right to vote and restrict that scope of democracy. The identity of the parties, by the way, switches around. It isn't always the Democrats pushing for expanded voting rights and the Republicans pushing to restrict them. Quite frequently, it's been the other way around. But I came out of learning this history having a renewed respect for the role of strong political parties as a kind of surprising engine of democratic participation, which isn't necessarily what I understood going in.
What role have the courts played in determining the right to vote?
Another surprise. For somebody like me, I'm a constitutional lawyer. I grew up, went to law school thinking, hey, that Supreme Court is going to be the ultimate protector of our liberties and the ultimate tribune of democratic values. But actually, throughout American history, the courts have largely been absent from the fight for effective voting rights. They had a doctrine they called the political question doctrine. It goes back all the way to the early years of the country. They just thought it was too political intrinsically for them to have to referee some of these election disputes. And when you think about how mad a lot of people got after the Bush v. Gore ruling, you kind of see why. There's only two periods in American history where the courts, and especially the Supreme Court, really stepped in and played a very big role. One time good, one time not so good. In the 1960s, amid the turmoil of the civil rights movement, the Supreme Court articulated the doctrine of one person, one vote. The idea that you had to have these votes mean something and mean something equal. And so that you couldn't have legislative districts be really uneven in how many people were in them. And these were famous cases called Baker versus Carr and other big cases from the Earl Warren Court that really had a big impact on how democracy worked in America. But that was about it. That was the only time the court really stepped in ahead of everybody else. The other time was in the last few years. The Supreme Court under John Roberts has been very activist, very interventionist in striking down laws that I believe protect American democracy. In Citizens United in 2010, a 5-4 majority struck down decades of campaign finance law that tried to restrict the role of the biggest money in American politics. And then in 2013, the exact same 5-4 majority gutted the Voting Rights Act in a case called Shelby County. This was the most successful civil rights law on the books. And the Supreme Court said it wasn't needed in its full strength anymore and tore the heart out of it. So I would say lately the Supreme Court's been pretty important, but not in a good way.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, and author of the book, The Fight to Vote. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. You said a bit about this earlier, but who have been some of the key figures historically in the fight to vote?
Well, like I said, Benjamin Franklin, I always knew I loved him, but I didn't know that this was one of the reasons. Not only did he fight in 1776, behind the closed doors of the Constitutional Convention, he prevented the other delegates from writing a property requirement into the Constitution, the idea that only the wealthy could vote. Another person who plays a central role is Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist leader, who at the end of the Civil War really understood that the next great fight was the fight for voting rights. There are heroes and heroines who are less known. For example, the women, young women especially, who won the 19th Amendment, the constitutional change that guaranteed the right to vote for women, are not as well known to those of us today, even people who know a lot about this stuff. People like Alice Paul and Lucy Burns and Inez Mulholland, they were audacious and they kind of pushed their elders aside and said, we're not going to settle for half measures. We want a constitutional amendment. And they engaged in incredibly creative civil disobedience and activism and actually won it. And one of the enjoyable parts of researching and writing the book is the chance to tell their story to a wider audience.
Looking over the course of our history, to what extent have we made progress in voting rights?
Emphatically, there's been progress. You know, we started and we weren't a democracy, and nobody pretends that we were a democracy. And we had these bold ideas about the consent of the governed, but they weren't reality even then, of course. And over time, we widened that circle of democracy. First, the property requirement fell. White men who didn't own property, basically the angry white working class of its day, demanded the right to vote. And in the 1820s especially, they achieved that much wider franchise. And among other things, the creation of the world's first mass political party, the Democrats, as we know them now. Then after the Civil War, in the 15th Amendment, African Americans were guaranteed the right to vote. There was actually a true flowering of democracy in the South. You had 90% voter participation rates among black men, hundreds elected to state legislatures and Congress and as governor, but it was crushed. That right was basically withdrawn in the face of terrorism, in the face of the Ku Klux Klan and political cowardice. And something similar, although not as well known and not as bad, something similar happened in the North because the cities of the North were now filled with immigrants. They weren't immigrants from Mexico, like people yell about today in some circles. They were from Ireland and Italy and Europe. But a lot of the blue bloods, the elites of those days, got very worried about them voting and having too much power. And they actually put in place a bunch of restrictions that made it harder for people to vote in the North as well, for working people to vote and immigrants and non-English speakers. And adding to that the new role, which was unusual and new then, of big money in politics from the kind of robber barons of the Gilded Age. And in the late 1800s, American democracy actually moved backwards. And it's an important lesson that there's been progress, but it doesn't only go inexorably in one direction. The 20th century saw a lot of forward movement. New laws in the progressive era to give the right to vote, for example, to people for United States Senator instead of having state legislatures do it. Women winning the right to vote. And of course, the great triumphs of the civil rights movement with the Voting Rights Act, with constitutional amendment banning poll taxes, requiring people to pay to be able to vote, lowering of the voting age. We really expanded the formal rights of democracy to their widest level. But once again, in recent years, we are at risk of moving backwards. You really have a concerted push to enact laws and policies that make it harder for a lot of people to vote. So we're kind of at a tipping point, and I hope that we're not at a time when we're going to be seen as moving backwards as opposed to moving forwards.
In what ways has it been made more difficult to vote over the past 15 years?
There have been a number of ways. There's been a profusion of laws, dozens of laws passed all over the place. Everything from cutbacks in early voting, especially on the days used by African Americans and churchgoers. The Sunday before Election Day is known as Souls to the Polls, and a lot of states cut those off. Restrictions on voter registration drives, making it harder to register people to vote. Attacks on Election Day registration. Requirements, demands in states like Kansas and Arizona that people should have to show a birth certificate or some other proof of citizenship, which can often be quite expensive, to vote. And voter ID laws all over the place that are very carefully crafted to cut out or to diminish the chance of participation for voters of color, young people, and poor people. And it's important to note, I'm actually for voter ID. I think it makes sense for people to have to be who they say they are and to have to show it. It's not crazy to ask people to prove it in something important like this. What I'm against is requiring forms of ID that lots of people don't have. And these voter ID laws, the ones that are controversial, about 11% of eligible voters just don't have that paperwork, don't have a driver's license or something like that. A good example is the law in Texas. It's somewhat notorious. This is the law that was carefully crafted by the Republican legislature in Texas. You cannot use your University of Texas student ID as your government ID card, but you can use your concealed carry gun permit. The partisan consequences of that perhaps look pretty obvious. And that law quickly disenfranchised 608,000 people in Texas, actual voters, registered voters, who didn't have the requisite paperwork, according to a federal court that found it to be racially discriminatory, illegal, and unconstitutional. So these laws are happening all over the place, and they're justified supposedly because of a need to fight against voter fraud. But the kind of potential misconduct that they would prevent is basically one kind, in-person voter impersonation. And you're more likely to be hit by lightning in the United States than to commit in-person voter impersonation. It is vanishingly rare.
How have the state voting restrictions affected election turnout and outcome?
We don't really know for sure. There's a lot of factors that go into turnout, who the candidate is, and all sorts of other things. People, even when there aren't barriers, sometimes turn out and sometimes they don't. And I've been very careful not to make claims that, oh my goodness, this voting law or that voting law, you know, tipped the election. Having said that, there's starting to be more and more evidence that these do have an impact. The GAO, the Government Accounting Office, the nonpartisan think tank that works for the Congress, respected by both Republicans and Democrats, looked at this very question. They looked at the laws in Tennessee and in Kansas, and they concluded that those states' new voting laws in fact did depress turnout, but only among some, only among African Americans. There's another study that was done recently by the University of California that seems to suggest an even bigger impact. I'm not sure what I think of that study, but the GAO study is pretty compelling. And, you know, generally speaking, GAO is regarded as esteemed and bulletproof. And, you know, I always say if these laws really are reducing turnout, finally a government program that works as intended. Since there's little genuine justification for them, you have to wonder what the true motive really is.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, and author of the book, The Fight to Vote. What is the relative influence of state versus federal laws on voting?
Well, we don't have one national election. We don't even have 50 state elections. Elections are run by thousands of counties all over the country. And this localism is kind of a remnant of how the country got started. These 13 colonies had their own election systems, and when they became states, they had their own election systems, and they didn't decide to systematize it and nationalize it during the Constitution. So the states have developed over time as the principal creators of election law, and they each run their own election their own way. It's often been a push and pull between the national needs and the states. James Madison saw this as a real problem when they wrote the Constitution. He thought that state legislatures were prone to manipulation and mischief. And he thought state legislators would pass laws and make rules to disenfranchise voters, to disenfranchise their opponents' voters, to gerrymander, to draw the district lines in an unfair way, all of which, of course, has been borne out as a real risk. So Madison insisted that they write into the Constitution something called the Elections Clause, which hasn't been used all that much, and people don't really know that much about it. But it gives Congress the power to override state voting laws, precisely because they thought state legislators would abuse that power. And the Supreme Court just last year resoundingly upheld the use of that Elections Clause as a protection for voting rights. It's often been the case that the breakthroughs for voting, especially protection of minority rights, has come when the national government has gotten involved. We saw that most significantly during the Voting Rights Act. That was not a constitutional amendment, it was a law. But what it said was that states with a history of discrimination in voting, if they wanted to change their voting rules, had to get permission in advance from the federal government, from the Justice Department or a federal court. And that turned out to make a big, big difference in protecting the rights of millions of people.
What do you see as the key problems with our current voting system in the U.S.?
Right now, there are a few big problems, and they mostly overlap. Yes, there's this conscious effort to come up with crafty new rules that slice up the electorate and make it harder for people to vote. And so you have the challenge of the Supreme Court and its very regressive doctrine in this area as we try to stop this wave of laws which have an impact in many instances of turning away voters. But a bigger, longer-term problem is the way we run elections in the United States is ramshackle, it's antiquated, and it makes these problems so much worse. The biggest positive change that could make a difference is if we change the way we registered voters in the United States. Right now, so many people, when they move from place to place, they fall off the voter rolls, or they're never on there in the first place, or the rolls are filled with errors. And there's tens of millions of people who should be registered who just aren't. If we move to automatic, universal, permanent voter registration, like so many other democracies have, it would add 50 million people to the rolls, it would cost less, and it would be more accurate and curb the potential for fraud. And the exciting development is that this idea of moving in this direction, this idea of modernizing our election systems, is taking hold. You have Oregon and California last year passed automatic voter registration for anyone who interacted with the Department of Motor Vehicles. That's moving and about to be enacted into law, if it hasn't already, in West Virginia in a bipartisan way. It passed the legislature in New Jersey, although Governor Chris Christie vetoed it. President Obama talked about it before the Illinois legislature and urged them to act. It may even be on the ballot in Arizona. This is sort of a brush fire of reform that's happening all over the place. And so if we could modernize our voter registration, that would go a long way. The other two big areas have to do with the role of money. We now have concentrated political wealth like we've not seen since the Gilded Age. In the last election, the top 100 donors gave more than the 4.75 million small donors combined. That's not sustainable. And there are things we can do about that: public financing of elections, constitutional change at the Supreme Court. And a third area where there's a big problem is in what we would call gerrymandering, the way the legislative lines are drawn that dampen competition and give people a lot of reasons to stay home because there's no real fight that they can even vote in. And there, too, there are changes that can be made. There's increased momentum for nonpartisan redistricting commissions to draw the lines that sort of take this out of the hands of the politicians. And that started to move all over the country, most recently in Ohio. So there are big problems, but there are also big solutions and new momentum behind those solutions.
Are there any additional problems and solutions you would like to mention?
One area that's of great interest to a lot of people has to do with an overlap between the problems in our criminal justice system and our elections. We are one of the few countries where there are a lot of people who are barred from voting because of a past criminal conviction, a felony conviction. This is mostly a remnant of the laws from the Jim Crow era, although it's actually in the Constitution authorized to have felony disenfranchisement. But as a lot of people have now come to understand, our criminal justice system over-incarcerates, over-criminalizes, and we have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison population. There's a very heartening and exciting left-right movement to reduce sentences and to end mass incarceration. And a lot of those same unlikely allies are coming to see that felony disenfranchisement is kind of a side effect of those criminal laws. And so the Brennan Center, which I lead, and other voting rights groups have been working to restore the right to vote to people who are, you know, back in their community, they're paying taxes, trying to do the right thing, but still can't vote. And this is something that's now being done by left and right. One of the great champions for this restoration of voting rights, for example, in the Senate is Rand Paul of Kentucky. And you're starting to see progress all over the place. But there are three states today where if you've had a felony conviction at any stage in your life, you are barred from voting for your lifetime. Florida, Virginia, and Iowa. Lots of people say, Iowa? They're so nice there. Why would they have that? But Florida and Virginia are the biggest areas with the biggest problems. And there are millions of people affected by this around the country.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say when you look at the long history of this fight to vote, it's always been a fight. It's always been something we've had to demand because democracy is such a powerful idea. And progress over the long run has been strong. As Dr. King said in his speech on voting rights, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But we can go backwards as well as forward. And I think this is a potential tipping moment. We could have another period, as we've had before, where we see a constriction, a restriction of democratic rights and participation, or we could move forward with a new energy to revitalize our institutions, to revitalize how we run elections, to finally take on this role of big money in politics and other things. It's really up to all of us to make that happen. So it's an exciting, if somewhat unnerving, moment.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You are just listening to Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law and author of the book, The Fight to Vote, published in 2016 by Simon & Schuster. For more information, check on the web at brennancenter.org. That's BRENNANCENTER.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.